Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Luxman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area and worldwide on www.irishradio.com. So whether you're here in New York City or in Ireland or somewhere else further afield, sit back, relax, agus fáilte isteach. For those of you who don't already know about us, Luxman Ireland House is New York University's Centre for Irish and Irish-American Studies. The centre was inspired by the vision and philanthropy of the late Lewis L. Luxman and Loretta Brennan Luxman, and since its foundation in 1993, Luxman Ireland House has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish. Our home is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Ireland proves that the impact of a country upon the world often bears very little relation to its physical size. Joyce, Yeats, Shaw, Beckett, Wilde. You need not mention these writers' first names to recognize their importance to world literature, and thus Ireland's. In-depth study of Irish society and culture helps us understand Ireland's broader significance through its colonial and post-colonial relationship with Britain, its links with the US and the wider world, its contribution to literature and the arts, both ancient and modern, its dual language tradition, our rival national narratives, and the far-reaching effects of emigration. On the matter of migration, today I'm going to talk a little bit about this topic. It is close to my own heart and to that of Luxman Ireland House, NYU. In discussing migration, I will draw on materials from the Archives of Irish America and from the Luxman Ireland House Oral History Collection. I didn't grow up the daughter or even the niece of Irish immigrants, but I did grow up listening to a particular story of people emigrating. From quite a young age, this story really interested me. It's the narrative of a family, the McCarthys, who were referred to as the Macs, who were forced to emigrate from Ireland's picturesque corner of West Cork to London in the post-World War II period. As my father tells it, the family was poor, at least in the material application of that term. Frequently, my father or one of his brothers was sent up to the Macs with some fresh cow's milk. This was one part of a barter arrangement whereby my relative would return to the Nighan family farm with the daily newspaper, which by that time of the day had been read by the McCarthys. This type of neighbourly interaction and mutual dependence was entirely natural in Irish rural society in this era. And there was one particular detail of the story that I liked, that being that while the Macs were socioeconomically deprived, one might say, it did not diminish their seeking to know about what was going on in the world around them and how they engaged with a world far beyond their own through the columns of the popular provincial newspaper, then known as the Cork Examiner and colloquially referred to as the paper. My father recalls childhood memories of the Mac sons leaving for England one by one. Eventually they were all gone, all the boys at least. There wasn't much for them in Ireland. Times were tough in the 40s and 50s. In different circumstances, it might have been my father making that decision to uproot. In time, the McCarthy homestead fell into disrepair. And by the time I first remember seeing the house in the early 1980s, its roof had caved in and it was the only physical reminder or proof of the story as my father had related it. Later, my father would leave his rural community and set up home 200 miles away in County Wicklow. He was a more willing emigrant and had the luxury of being able to stay within the borders of the land of his birth. Sometime in the 1990s, an acupuncturist came to work on my mother in our family home. While the needles penetrated her body, the acupuncturist chatted with my father to kill time. His London twang intrigued my father, especially when he said that his name was John McCarthy. Surely with a name like that, you must have some Irish in you. John indicated that indeed he did. My father hails from a little hamlet in West Cork, he replied. My father was instantly interested in case he might know the acupuncturist's relatives. John hesitated in naming the specific place of his father's birth, a place name only instantly recognisable to those of the immediate locality. But when pushed by my father, he uttered the name of the area in which my father had been born and raised, the same small area from which the McCarthy family had emigrated. My father was overcome with memories as he gazed upon the man who was the son of one of the McCarthys to whom my father had delivered milk as a child. What were the chances that almost 50 years after last seeing these men, that one of their sons would stand in my father's house? John McCarthy had married a lady who had grown up in the town to which my father had migrated 2 decades earlier. It was almost too unbelievable to be true. And yet I witnessed it, so I know it is true, at least in large part. In this interaction, now almost 20 years ago, the seeds of my own interest in emigration were planted. In fact, in large part, my research is essentially an attempt to complete the story of the Macs on which I had been raised. I had and still have an insatiable appetite to learn about what happened to the protagonists in my father's childhood memory. Not in the specific sense of tracking the McCarthys specifically, more in the sense of using their story as an entree to further understanding the arc of a family or individual life history, especially when it involves an act of migration. So for over a decade now, in various ways, I have explored the experiences and stories of people emigrating. When I came to New York in 2006, it was to undertake some research for my doctoral thesis. What that was about was a comparison of Irish immigrants who left Ireland in the 15 years or so after World War II, and I compared the experiences of Irish immigrants who settled in New York as opposed to those who settled in London. So after having conducted some oral histories in London in the Irish community, I came to New York and started undertaking interviews in the Irish community here in New York. And I focused in on people who had participated in county associations. Why did I choose that? Well, for practical purposes, by means of comparison, there is and there was a network of county associations in London. So it was a nice way for me to compare experiences by using the associations as kind of a framework to compare. Soon after I came here, I had the opportunity to interview a lady who was born in my hometown of Arklow, County Wicklow. Her name is Mary Thomas. She was born in 1921, the 7th of 10 children. We're just going to listen now to Mary as she talks about the Wicklow Association and the general operations of county associations as she saw them soon after she came to New York in 1953, having first emigrated to England, to Birkenhead in England in 1939. So here's Mary.
County associations here were mainly social and fraternal. Ours are social and fraternal.
Right.
Some of them, the bigger ones, let's say Kerry, Cork, Tipperary, Mayo, those that have large amounts of there's not that many immigrants from Wicklow, but there are from the bigger counties. Kerry, for instance. And they were mostly formed years ago so that the immigrants would have a place to go. They would have an association and they could go there. And if they were out of work, well, they would, if it was benevolent, then they would, you know, give them a little give them a hand out, or I'll help them out to until they found a job.
Right.
And then you kind of always, it wasn't mandatory, but it was kind of expected that then you kind of gave a little, became a member, and you associated, you gave the association, you supported them. If they had a dance, in other words, well, you can't have a dance or run anything without bodies. So you're expected to, you know, support them and give a contribution. And that's how they were in the beginnings, because they would only have it in a small place, maybe a room on the side of a pub, where they would discuss, and they'd have little outings and they'd have picnics and stuff like that. So mostly they were, and if somebody died and they didn't have a job, or they couldn't bury them, well, you helped to bury them. Years ago it wasn't as expensive as it is today. And so we have that saying, well, we bury our dead. And so that was really the beginnings of all associations, including ours.
And do you think in the last 50 years or so, Mary, that you've seen the Wicklow one, when was it at its strongest, in the 50s?
When it was in the 50s, in the 50s it was the strongest. We used to hold our dances down in St. Mary's. It was of the Eastern Rite, as a Catholic church, but of the Eastern Rite. Not that that made any difference, but they had a nice big hall. And most of our people, it was more practical to have a dance down there, because that's where most of our people lived, around the Manhattan area.
That excerpt from Mary Thomas's interview touches on most of the salient aspects of county associations as they have operated and continue to operate in New York City. She mentions the idea of charity, of benevolence, fraternalism, mutualism, and these ideas were the bedrock of these organizations in terms of helping each other out. She touches on the idea of social events, a place to gather. What's also interesting is how she obliquely touches on the notion of where immigrants are living at the time. There is a cluster of Wicklow immigrants, Arklow immigrants in particular, around Chelsea, the West Village area, people associated with the waterfront, etc., etc. And this is why you see the impulse to hold Wicklow dances in the location she mentions. So on a number of levels, this oral history, the small excerpt from a much longer oral history, reveals very interesting insights as to the role of county associations in Irish New York. The next excerpt is from Kevin Morrissey's interview. Kevin grew up on a rural farm in a village outside of Tuam, County Galway. He arrived in New York in 1957 after being invited and assisted over by a relative. He talks here about the role of county associations, the social and fraternal and mutualistic support they provided.
The reason that county organizations survived, of course, was the need for camaraderie and touch with home. And they were so necessary and so highly thought of in the early part of the century, I'm sure, is because they provided that kind of contact with people from your own parish, mm-hmm. from your own county and everything else. And people were parochial in those times.
You know, yeah.
They didn't think of somebody, a Galway person meeting somebody from Cabin, you know, considered them to be an outsider.
Yeah. Something.
So the county organizations were the touch with home. But they provided an awful lot of services at that time, you know, that opportunities to find jobs, you know, if you were ill. Aside from the sociability of the occasions, you know, it was the good times and the helping each other in bad times.
Do you have any idea what the membership was like around that time? You know,
very strong in those years. It was the apex of Irish membership in organizations. When I came here, it was stupendous, really.
Was the Galway Association open to both sexes at the time?
Oh yeah, but it was called the Galway Women's Association.
But women were allowed to join.
Oh, of course, yeah. But none of them had ever been president.
Okay.
And we never had a women's auxiliary, though Mayo, for instance, did.
Yeah.
And that was changed also. But the Gormans, and, you know, it was called the Gormans, and it was only in, I don't know how many years ago, less than 15 years ago, it was changed to the Galway
Association. And were women, were there, I suppose it was more predominantly a male pursuit, though, in terms of...
It was about equal, because everybody brought a wife in there, practically.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And the women were vocal, too, so they had an equal. For all intents and purposes, the women had an equal say there.
Right.
Except they didn't
they
didn't become president.
But they had other officers? They had
they
other
would
positions?
Have secretarial, yeah, and that kind of thing. You know. Yeah, they did, yeah.
Okay.
Sure, yeah.
Already in the excerpts from Mary and Kevin, it is clear that the county loyalty and allegiance to people from the same county was a really important motivator and a practical way of dividing the Irish community up in New York to make it more manageable, so that individual counties looked after the welfare and needs and sociability of each county. The following excerpt is going to develop this a little bit more and touch on it in its relation to the Gaelic Athletic Association. We're now going to hear from the late John Kane. John was born in Sligo and was raised between there and Roscommon before he left Ireland in 1954. He went on to live in England and in Canada before he arrived in New York City and married an Irish woman, Anne. He's now going to talk a little bit about the role of county associations and how county loyalty and allegiances and the role of GAA in a way played into how county associations operated. Here's John.
But from my own, and I'm not saying this because it was myself that was there, but I think that, I mean, you will hear some people saying, well, he took care of footballers. That's right. Sure I did. Well, it took care of a lot of other people too. I mean, not all our membership was up in Gaelic Park then for Sligo. But did we have our favourites? Well, if you say you didn't have favourites, you'd be telling a lie. Did you ever discriminate against somebody because you had two left feet, or because you didn't go to the church that I go with, or you played with Cork, or never? No. And I don't think that there's one person that you could meet that was willing to tell the truth and say, John was like that.
Yeah.
Because John was not like that. But he came up the hard way. When I looked out at that black man, I could see me in him. What we went through when we came to, well, the first time we really saw it was we came to the U.S., because I never experienced that in England. But then again, was it there? Maybe.
Did you become, like, in a way, I would imagine they probably did, like somebody, say, in Gaelic Park, or say if you were, I don't know, at a Sligo Association event or something like that, whereby you were a good person to, if you were someone coming over looking for a job, that they'd make themselves known to you or whatever?
Yes.
Oh, I would say so.
Yeah.
There was a lot of people that came with John's name to this country, and that's all they had was John's name.
Brilliant.
And phone number. A lot of people, and he was very good to the young Irish coming out, and that's why he was honoured by so many of the associations.
What better way to promote the welfare of Irish immigrants and their families than by providing them with a means to secure employment? Networking was a key feature of county societies long before the term was coined in its most contemporary sense. And we just heard John and Anne Kane make a reference to that. We're going to now hear an excerpt from another immigrant who explained how he knew about the Mayo Men's Patriotic and Benevolent Association from the very first day he arrived in New York. We're now going to hear from John Jennings. John arrived here as a young man in 1948, having been born in Mayo and raised in Kildare. Let's have a listen to what John has to say. So, can you remember, were you always aware of there being a Mayo Men's Association?
Oh, I was, from the first day I came here, because the word of mouth was, if you have any trouble getting a job, see somebody because the people that were in the Mayo Association had influence. When Dwyer was mayor, he had appointed the police commissioner who was from a couple of villages away.
What was his name?
Murtha. And then he had another one that was for the fire department. I'm getting too old to think all the names. But he appointed all of these Irish, you know. So there were always people in these jobs. The people that were up in Gaelic Park and played football, they got jobs with the beer and the whiskey and the soda companies, you know, White Rock and so. So there was opportunities there if that's what you wanted to do.
But you never had. Well, was it that you had no interest in being an active participant in it, or that you were just because of your career and stuff like that and the family?
No, it's strictly the career has to take preference to everything else.
But it was. I'm just trying to establish it wasn't that you had any kind of ideological problem with
absolutely not. But we had even when I was traveling, I would come back from the West Coast or someplace, and go from the airport right to the Denver dance, you know, suitcase and all. But I couldn't do that thing to have meetings in the middle of a week or something. No way in hell.
Yeah.
I couldn't schedule around their meetings. I had to schedule around what I wanted to do, you know.
Okay.
John Jennings just alluded to how his career prevented him from being very active in the Mayo Association for long periods of time. And we always need to bear in mind the practical implications of people's lives, their jobs, where they lived, their family lives, all played a role as to whether somebody was able to be active in county associations or not. And then many others simply were not interested. I had a lot of fun a couple of years ago when two Kerry ladies came in to see me, Kathleen O'Sullivan and Josephine Downing. They both arrived here in the early 1950s and were active in the Kerry Ladies Auxiliary for quite a period of time. In the following excerpt, you'll hear them talk about the practical implications of how people interacted with the Kerry Ladies or otherwise.
I guess there was a big flow of Irish in New York then, really.
Oh, yeah, not less. Yes.
You know, we met them from all different areas. And the Kerry Ladies Association was great. Then we ran dances. Mm-hmm. Our first one was in the Yorkville Casino on 86th Street in the small ballroom. That was too small. The next year we went to the bigger one.
City Centre, was it?
That? No, this is the Yorkville Casino we had the first one.
And what year was that?
I'd say that was 53 or 54.
So when you joined the Kerry Ladies first, how many women would typically be at the meeting? Used to have monthly meetings?
Yes.
And how many be at them?
About 15 or 20.
And what age group women were they?
Some young. Some stayed on, some didn't.
Yeah, but they were older members. Sure, remember.
Oh, they were. They were the ones that kept it going. Helen Sullivan and Bridie Roan.
She was from Bingle,
you know.
And she was from 25 Main Street, Dingle. Right, that was the soul.
What was her name?
Bridie Roan.
Okay. Yeah.
And that was Joan Roan. Remember Joan?
Joan was younger. She went back to Ireland and married. And Mary Quinn went back to Ireland, back to Dingle, both of them.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, but there were a good few young, immigrants like you coming over who were
there was an awful lot of people.
Yeah.
And going into the Kerry Ladies to organise these things.
Yeah, some of them went in, some of them went in, but then you wouldn't see them again, you know. But they all came back when we ran our dances. They were terrific, really. First when we had the City Centre, what an overflowing crowd, because it wasn't just people from Kerry, they always went where there was dances.
Mm-hmm. Remember the City Centre to go into the dance hall, that was line 2 blocks long.
But that tells you how much young Irish were here in the 50s.
Yes.
Unbelievable, you know, really and truly. And our prophets then would go to the home for special children. Not back then, I don't think.
No, they didn't have it that time, I don't think.
They didn't have it, but later years, because we ran it up until, what, 10 years ago?
Okay,
I think.
Yeah.
And,
so what do you think made ye stick with, like, what was, like, why did some people drop off and some people stay involved in the Kerry Ladies, do you think?
Well, I think what happened, some got married and moved out. Really. You know, don't you think?
Yeah, I think it's mostly all that matter moved away to different places,
they moved,
you know?
Away.
Yeah.
And it wasn't as convenient then to be coming into the meetings,
yeah,
and stuff.
Exactly.
But there's a lot of other people that never went, like early Miss Kinnegar, so she was in Dingle,
yeah.
John, Big John Tupper's wife. And you that crowd, her sister Bridie. There
was
a lot.
Of things, yeah.
And, you know, like, an awful lot of people that was here, they didn't join. They weren't interested in that, was it, probably?
Yeah. Slow to shirk from celebrating county pride, Irish women have a long history of organisation and participation in county associations. Although they were initially segregated by gender, it wasn't long before the men's groups had auxiliary associations for the Irish women. Garbed in colourful uniforms or beautiful ball gowns, they made a striking impression at county events, as well as marching in formation at the St. Patrick's Day Parade or participating at the annual FESH. The ladies clearly added more than just aesthetics to these gatherings, however. They supported the initiatives of their male counterparts, but they also ran their own very successful fundraising and social events. Daughters were initiated into county rituals from a young age, beginning as flower girls at the annual balls, especially that of the United Irish Counties Association, and then they often came of age as leaders in the ladies' auxiliaries. By now, all the men's groups have extended membership to women. The smaller Irish counties often pioneered the combination of the men's and ladies' organisations. Then, under newly made banners which privileged county affiliation over gender, women quickly stepped into the roles of officer and president. And in the following excerpt, we'll continue listening to Kathleen O'Sullivan and Josephine Downing talking about the Kerry Association and the Kerry Ladies Auxiliary and how they operated, often hand in glove in terms of their operations.
They always supported our dances. Even in later years, when we switched to Astoria Manor, having our dinner dances.
Oh yeah, they were very good.
It was amazing.
But we were never very much involved with them. They had theirs and we had ours.
Mm. But they would support us and everything else, and then we did likewise with their dance.
But it's not like, I used to imagine, like, say, that the Kerry men would be having their meeting and that, like, he'd be in another place, and you know, no, it wasn't. It was completely separate organisation.
Yeah. Oh, yes, because the charter or whatever is in that, you know, when they were organised back by that Julia Kelleher, is it?
Yes.
In 2009. I think they might have met in 2007. But those were great women to keep.
Julia Lawler.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, to keep it going at that time.
Yeah.
Really. I don't know too much about what they did.
So do you think that between, say, about 1907 or 1909 when it was incorporated?
Yeah, it was 1909, it was chartered, but I read something about 2007 when they met.
Yeah. Do you think between then and, say, you joined in 1951 or 52 that it was running all that time?
Yes. Okay. When we went, there was a... I just think of Bridie Ronan. There was just a few running it.
Elizabeth Chattel?
Yes.
Mary
about
Shane.
Five or six. And that first meeting, I think there must have been a Murphy's Hotel on the west side. And that was where we joined up. And they got older. We got younger ones to join. Some stayed. And more didn't. A lot of them stayed, though. Maureen Gallivan Page out in Jersey.
Yes, she was American born, yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah, there was quite a few. A few of them went back to Ireland.
And did you get many American born joining?
We did have a few back then, didn't we?
But it was mostly Irish born.
Mostly Irish.
Yeah, there were so many young Irish out here from Kerry, different parts.
So what were the big events of the year? The dance? Is that?
Oh, yeah. We had two dances, didn't we? We had one in February and one in Thanksgiving. And a communion breakfast. and seven, I just came across some cards. We had, I don't know how many years they lasted. I found cards from 73 and 74, where we had a communion breakfast in the Astoria Manor. Not the Astoria Manor, here in the city. The Waldorf Astoria.
Oh, wow.
Yes, the Waldorf Astoria. Yeah. Yeah. Remember that?
Yes.
I think maybe the last one was 74. But there, you know, we gave it. Karaman came to that and supported us.
Mm-hmm.
When I look back on it, it was a great entertaining. My sister Nora chaired that one in 1954. The reason I know now, because I'm finding the cards.
1954?
No.
1974, you said, did you?
Yeah, I think it was 74. Really, because we had the communion breakfast. They only lasted about 4 years, 73 and 74, and we didn't go back there after that because it got too expensive for communion breakfast, you know.
So then you'd have the two dances then and the communion breakfast.
Yes.
So what was the rigmarole for St. Patrick's Day? That was a...
Fighting over those costumes. They had to attend 2/3 of the meeting before we could give them a costume. And those that didn't weren't too happy with us, but we had to have some way of...
being fair.
Yes.
At this point, I'd like to introduce another county, having listened to the Kerry ladies. We listen to an excerpt now from an interview I undertook in 2006 with Ellen Smith. Ellen was born and raised in Newmarket, County Cork, and came to the United States in 1950. She and I, in our conversation, discussed many aspects of the Cork Ladies Auxiliary and more generally the Irish community as she found it when she arrived here in 1950. It is interesting to hear her talk about the intergenerational community, the people who'd come here in the 1920s. The role of that older community as it existed prior to the people who'd arrived in the post-World War II period was absolutely essential to the assimilation and ease with it which newly arrived Irish immigrants could adapt to New York life. Take a listen to what Ellen had to say.
You became involved in the Cork Ladies Auxiliary in what year, Ellen?
In 52.
52, so you were only here about...
I was only a couple of years, yeah.
How did you get involved in it?
Through my sister and I think we might have met at the Irish dance halls. We met two girls, they were sisters, the O'Sullivans, and they were from Skibbereen. And they also had jobs working for families. They were domestic workers, and we would go to the Caravan Ballroom at 59th Street, and then there was another Irish dance hall, the Tuxedo, and I think it was at those dance halls we met these two girls from Cork, and they had a relative, Anna O'Driscoll, and she was very involved in the Cork Ladies Auxiliary.
And was she an aunt of theirs or something? Or?
She was maybe a cousin.
Okay.
She was also from Bantry, I guess.
Okay.
I think they were from near Bantry. And the O'Sullivan girls had joined the Cork Ladies. And for some reason, they encouraged me to come. They said, come to the meeting and join. My sister didn't, oddly enough. But I did. I don't know why. And...
So none of your aunts or uncles were ever involved in county associations at all?
No.
Do you have any ideas to why they didn't?
My uncle that I lived with joined the Cork Men soon when he was in World War One, a young man, single. But he said the Cork Association had some kind of a rift and they broke up. And he wasn't very pleased with the breakup. And he did not continue in the association. When the Cork Association first was formed, it was only men from Cork City. And then later on, they become the entire county of Cork. But he used to talk about the old Cork men and the new Cork men. So they had some breakup.
Right.
And he did not continue.
Do you have any ideas what that was about or anything?
I don't know.
Right.
It was very easy for an organization to... It happens today.
Yeah.
Simple rifts. Maybe one person wanted to be president and he didn't get in. And then the others, they had the cliques. They had a clique, you know, and something happened there. But he used to talk about it, that he belonged to the old Cork men.
Really?
Yes.
So he never went back to it?
He never went back, no.
So your joining the Cork Ladies had nothing to do with your Uncle Jack?
No.
How did he feel about you getting involved in the ladies?
Oh, he was quite pleased. He was quite pleased, really, because he thought it was good for us, you know.
And out of the other 7 or 8 of them that were here in Cork, in New York, none of your other aunts or uncles ever been involved in
Never that? Involved with a county organization.
Okay.
No.
Do you have any ideas to why not, Ellen?
I think it wasn't popular. I really think the county organizations became very popular again because of the immigrants in the late 40s and the immigrants of the 50s.
Really?
Because if they didn't come that time, there wouldn't be any county organizations today.
Right.
There wouldn't be. They were ones that kept it going. And then they also got involved in the Hibernians associations, which I never did. The United Irish Counties was big, all because of the immigrants of the 50s. There was new blood, and there was new people. And I give them a great deal of credit for the Irish in New York today.
Really?
Those immigrants of the 50s, because they had intermarried, and they raised families, and they raised professional people of all kinds. Doctors, lawyers, dentists, teachers, and so on. And they have contributed a huge amount to today's Irish. They wouldn't have the dancing. They wouldn't have Irish dancing. They wouldn't have great musicians that they have today here. Only for
the people who came over then.
That came then.
Yeah.
Yes.
I guess with the way immigration, you know, you referenced that break, the Depression, and then into World War II, where there was no one coming over.
There was no one coming.
And then without that vital injection of bodies again from Ireland, that would have made a huge difference to the landscape of Irish organisations here.
Right. And I think the next break was when the Irish came in the 80s. Again, they have contributed quite a bit because they are like the ones that will carry on heritage.
Mm.
Again, but I think the immigrants of the 50s were more into it, you know. They all joined the Hibernians and they joined the county organizations and they would have dances. They'd be thousands. I remember they used to be in Manhattan Center. It's a huge place, packed with Irish, packed with these dances. You don't have that today.
And these were dances organized by the various county associations.
Right.
So you might meet these Sullivan sisters at a dance or something, and they tell you to come along to the Ladies Auxiliary of the Cork Association.
That's how I got to know the association was those ladies that we met, young girls like ourselves.
Can you remember going to the first meeting?
I remember the first, barely. I barely remember, but...
Where was it on, do you know?
I can't remember. They had a very popular place, the Irish Institute, which was at West 48 for years, where our meetings were held. But I have a feeling when I first joined, that institute wasn't built then. They hadn't that open. And I cannot remember where we had those meetings.
So when you went along to the meeting, can you remember, what was the age range of people there and things?
Oh, my goodness. There was a huge... Mrs. Cotter and Mrs. Scarry and Mrs. O'Leary, they were old women. They were like our mothers. They were mothers. There was a great... Yeah. And many times I went to the meeting and I said, I'm not coming back here again. There's nothing here for me. They're old ladies. But a few of the younger members kept going, and I think that's why I kept going. There was a few young members, like Pat Young O'Connor.
Right. Yeah,
she was there, and her sister, and the O'Sullivan sisters, and it was O'Donovan sisters, and they kept going, and they were like our age group. And then I think they encouraged me to keep going. Don't give up.
Don't give up.
Keep going and keep involved. And the what was so popular then, they started the communion breakfast.
Right.
Every organization, every county organization, they started this thing, and they all over the city, there were Irish communion breakfast. Was very popular at the time.
And that was a mass and then
a mass and a breakfast.
Okay.
Mass. And that brought a lot of Irish together.
So what were the main activities of the Lazy Hill Plenary?
Mostly to hold a dance maybe once a year in one of the halls, have a communion breakfast, and there was a few of them that used to help a great deal in a place. I think it's the Leo House in New York. It was a Catholic, a residence for Catholic travelers, and a lot of priests would stay there. And some of them would go and they would do some volunteer, and they talked a lot about the Leo House. I believe it's still there.
Okay. So they do fundraising for
and,
that or something?
And they would, yes, they would do some fundraising. And they were very good to the Carmelite missions. They had a very good friend, one priest, Father O'Callaghan. He was very involved in Irish organizations. A true Irishman, if there was ever a true religious great priest Irishman. And he encouraged the young Irish so much to keep going, keep Irish culture and heritage, keep your religion, go to the communion breakfast. And he was a great source of inspiration.
Right. What was the relationship like in the early, you know, in those early years between the Cork Ladies Auxiliary and the Corkmen's Association?
They had a good relationship because Mrs. Cotter, that I knew as the first president back then in 52, her husband was Jim Cotter, and he was very involved in the Cork Men.
Right.
You see, and they were husband and wife, and they had a good relationship.
Right.
You see. And they always really did. They had a good relationship.
And I've just seen here on this book that you have that the Ladies of the Auxiliary of the Cork Association was set up in 1916. So
first it started in 1916, yes.
Right.
But I think they fell apart in the Depression years and war years. And it was Father O'Callaghan and Jim Cotter, and I think there was a man by the name of O'Driscoll, started it out again in maybe 1946 or 47,
okay.
And they became active again,
okay.
And they reestablished,
okay.
In those years. And then we came in 50, and they didn't have too many members. And
really?
No, at that time when I joined, there wasn't too many members.
How many people would be on average at the meetings, maybe?
20.
Okay. And they were monthly meetings, were they?
They had a monthly meeting, yes. Yes.
So, I mean, generally in New York at the time, if there was probably a county association for every county and a ladies' auxiliary for nearly most of them, there must have been fierce activity in terms
huge.
Of communion breakfast, dances.
Huge. There was huge activity.
Like, used you go to everyone else's kind of, or
well,
a lot of them?
You know,
would
go to a lot of them. What would happen is they would have a dance, and you would pay maybe $2 at the door, and you'd go in, and there was tables and chairs and a big dance hall and a big band, several musicians, and you dance all night.
Right.
You see. And it only cost a couple of dollars.
Yeah.
You see.
And at these venues, it was almost exclusively Native Irish.
They were Native Irish. That's where everybody met. And it was just a great place to go. And it was dance halls.
Right.
It was a place to go and meet the crowd and dance.
Right.
Big dance halls.
For more than a century and a half, Irish county societies have come together on March 17th for a very public display of solidarity and ethnic pride. St. Patrick's Day has been and remains the high point of the year for most of them. Grand Marshals, as well as their aides and members of the parade committee, have frequently been drawn from the ranks of the county associations. The reunion aspect of the parade make assembling around the county banners a social occasion. There, in the side streets, old acquaintances are renewed and stories swapped before lining up to turn onto New York's Fifth Avenue. As silk banners heralding county origins make their annual excursion up that avenue, it becomes a ribbon of colour and historical memory. The honour of carrying the banner and leading the county unit is carefully bestowed. Marching behind it is often against high winds in cold rain or snow, but for many it is now a family tradition. And that notion of a family tradition will be picked up in the following excerpt that we'll now listen to. Mike Dunphy came to New York City at the age of 10 with his family from County Leash. He is past president of the County Leash Association of New York. And in what we'll listen to now, we'll hear about the family tradition of the Leash Association and St. Patrick's Day and the important role it plays for him, his extended family and friends.
Throughout, like when you were rearing the kids and everything like that, Mike, you, at least when you were in the New York metropolitan area, you stayed involved in the Leash Association.
Right, stayed involved in the Leash Association.
What was the draw for you with it? You know, especially say when you stopped playing the hurling and
well,
stuff.
I mean, my father and uncle and other people were still at least involved to the point that they would assemble for the St. Patrick's Day parade or have an annual dance or something else. So there's enough people around to have it. Then in the 80s, I mean, it just died down to just a handful of people trying to get together for the parade with the banner and stuff like that. And then my uncle died and I basically took over the reins and have the banner and got a new one in 2003. Line up people and any Leash person I see, I track them down. And a lot of them don't, you know, a lot of the people, some of the Leash people I heard with, you know, live around the area, but they have other things that they're doing. You know, they're involved in the Irish club around their area in Long Island or in Irish dancing or stuff, and they don't march with Leash every year. So we keep as many as we can to march with Leash.
Now, you mentioned earlier that your kids marched.
Oh, yeah, every
as
year.
Well. And
yeah.
So, I mean, was it important, or how did you instill, or have you tried to instill a sense of Irish identity in your children, Mike?
Well, I think as part of the thing they heard us talk about, you know, getting people out for the parade, and we brought them along at younger years, and, you know, they enjoyed the crack of going out and having a fun day and maybe being off school for a while. And now they feel an obligation to doing it. You know, I mean, I didn't tell them you have to do it, so to speak. But I think they look at it as, hey, no, there's no way we're going into parade. Because they know I'm going into parade and Fran's going in and whatever else. So they want to come down. And maybe one of the day out of high school, then a day out of college, I don't know, whatever it is, they continue to do it and bring some of their friends every year. He has a good friend from high school, has been marching with us for the last, I don't know, 14 years.
Yeah.
Seelaw, so it's not even an Irish name anywhere whatsoever.
Mm.
But and that's how it is. We got some other people with Irish ancestry that had no idea where it came from. Have been marching with us for 15 or 20 years. Some of the people that did football and hurling with us in the 60s and 70s, their children with their children march with us every year, even though their parents now are spend the winter in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
So they show up every year with their children and grandchildren to march with us.
I think it's clear at this point that county societies in New York have been dominated historically by those born in Ireland, the immigrant community. But of course, there has been participation by people born in America. Often children of Irish immigrants were completely indoctrinated in county associations from a young age. I'll quote a communication I received from one person of that generation from a few years ago. She said, "Yes, 'tis me, little Kathleen, as I was called then. Some people are born in a vaudeville trunk, and some people are born wrapped up in a county's banner." We've had some fantastic contributions to the Archives of Irish America from the children of Irish immigrants who grew up through these county associations. One such lady was the late Margaret Callahan, who left an important legacy to county association history and the history of the Armagh Society through her collection. In the following excerpt, we're going to hear from Eileen Howlihan Zurel. Eileen was the daughter of two Limerick immigrants who grew up attending Limerick Association activities right into her teenage years and beyond. It is interesting to hear the American-born perspective on these gatherings and how the Irish came together and interacted with the new generation of children born in the United States. Your father was involved in some Irish organizations, Can you tell me about them?
The Limerickmen's Benevolent and Social Society. That was very big in their lives. We went to lots of their dances on St. Patrick's Day, St. Patrick's Night. And I remember when I was small, I loved it because they would dress up the littler girls in pretty dresses, and we would present flowers to the officers. So we thought we were really quite extraordinary. But it was good fun. And I remember, too, going there when I was a teenager. I'd bring my girlfriends with me. And then by that time, we were dancing with the cops and the firemen, not with our uncles anymore.
So, and you enjoyed, I spoke to a lady recently who, like yourself, grew up the child of 20s immigrants, and she was saying at a certain point when she was about 15, she didn't want to go to those things anymore, you know?
Yeah, you do get away from it, but by the same token, on a St. Patrick's Night, and it used to be held on St. Patrick's Night, it was a nice place to go. It was safe. There was lots of good music, and as I said, cute cops and firemen. That was important.
Now we'll hear from somebody who had a similar background to that of Eileen Howland Zurel. This is Terry Conley Cook. Terry grew up in the Bronx, the daughter of two County Monaghan immigrants. In the following reflection, she'll talk about the role county associations played, and specifically the Monaghan Society, in her childhood and teenage years, and how she came of age through these associations.
We were raised thinking that everyone went to dances, Irish dances, that everybody went to church, everyone went to communion breakfast. We all went to the St. Patrick's Day Parade. It was a national holiday in the neighborhood. And it was just, we were all homogenized, you know. But in with the Irish were a lot of Americans, and of course the children all became American, and so there was a lot of intermarriage, and that meant that you married a German or an Italian. That was intermarriage, and this is when the group started to break up, because of course those children would most of them would move out of the neighborhoods. And then the whole thing would take on another slant. But it was magical. It was a magic circle. It was created by the societies, which was really a kind of like a center of their lives. It was created by the church, which was also the center. They all went to church. The churches were so crowded in those days that you couldn't even get seats. When I was growing up, everyone made their first Holy Communion. Everyone made confirmation. You were just raised in a group where everyone did the same thing. You had no idea what it was like outside until you left the circle.
Listening to Terry's reflections makes me think of what attracted me to studying these associations in the first place. The notion of gathering people together who are outside the homeland and connecting them in a way that is meaningful in terms of culture and in terms of pragmatic ideals that really play a role in the life of a newly arrived immigrant. They also remind me of a poem I came across, which was coined in 1928 and published in the Cork Association newsletter, The Rebel. Many of the themes in this poem are very salient and touch on many of the ideas that have come up in the oral histories we've been listening to over the last while. This poem is called Landing in New York. I am proud of the fact that I came from Cork, and that Corkmen I met here in New York, after leaving the county that all of us love, not a soul did I know who'd give me a shove. Push, should I say, but that word doesn't rhyme. At any rate, soon I had not even a dime. I was hungry too for a couple of days, and getting jobs entails many delays. I was homesick and sad as I wandered round, till one day by chance a Cork man I found. I told him my story. He asked me home. His family I met, I was one of their own. I will never forget how they took me in. It wasn't the story of no room at the inn. That night as I prayed on my bended knees to the good God above, who both hears and sees, I asked him to bless, to guard and protect the friends I have found and will never neglect. A few days after, in Gimble's big store, I worked at the job of sweeping the floor. At last payday came and a salary small that I spent for my friends on presents for all. A little while later, the Cork men I joined, and there many friends from home did I find. We spoke to each other of days long gone by. My heart it was happy and filled with joy. A new job they promised, it came in a week, and the following Monday a store did I seek that was painted in green with Butler the name. That's where I am now, the manager of fame. Over the past while, I've been dipping into the collection of interviews in the Archives of Irish America that form the Luxman Ireland House Oral History Collection. Our 300 interviews demonstrate a very wide variety of outlooks and backgrounds in the landscape that makes up Irish New York and beyond. It's a very rich collection, and it demonstrates the complexity of Irish America as it exists at any given point in time. To go back a little bit as to my interest in the topic of migration and how I came to Luxman Ireland House, I'd like to talk a little bit about my initial research in history. I undertook my bachelor's degree and my master's in University College Cork. The daughter of a Cork man who was raised in Wicklow, I was very happy to go back to the county of my ancestors, as it were, to engage with history. I had grown up on tales of West Cork in the period of the Troubles, I guess the first set of Troubles as we might refer to them now, the War of Independence, the Civil War. My great-grandfather had been very active in West Cork, and this had whetted my appetite and interest in history. Where my father was born and raised was actually about 6 miles from Ballinum Law, where Michael Collins was killed as well. So history, the political history of Ireland, was very much part of physically the landscape of where my father had been born and raised. And I had an interest in this from a very young age. We are coming towards the end of the programme for this week. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I want to thank you for listening to the Luxman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. Please do tune in next Saturday, same time, same place, WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area and worldwide on www.irishradio.com. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me, my email is ireland.house@nyu.edu and our telephone number is 212-998-3950. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to www.irishradio.com. Stay tuned for the Adrian Flannelly Show up next on WVNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you listening to irishradio.com, stay with us until noon. Have a good weekend. Slán go fóill.